In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Janina Fisher. Dr. Fisher is a licensed clinical psychologist and a former instructor at Harvard Medical School. Having trained directly with the likes of Bessel van der Kolk and Pat Ogden, she is now widely recognized as an international expert on the treatment of trauma. Janina is an advisory board member of the Trauma Research Foundation and the author of three books, including Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors, Transforming the Living Legacy of Trauma, and the Living Legacy Instructional Flipchart, which was published in 2022. She is best known for her work on integrating mindfulness-based interventions into trauma treatment, and she is also the creator of trauma-informed stabilization treatment. In this conversation, we discuss Dr. Fisher's experiences training with Bessel van der Kolk in the 1990s, the left and right brain split and how trauma gets stored in the body as implicit memories, the limitations of the uniconsciousness model, and why a parts paradigm is more effective for healing trauma, why secure attachment is the number one variable in mental health, and how to cultivate earned secure attachment internally, and more. You can learn more about Dr. Fisher's work at www.janinafisher.com. Okay, Janina, welcome to the summit. To get started, could you maybe tell us about your motivation to become a clinical psychologist? You know, what initially sparked that in you?
Well, actually, my children were the initial spark, because I remember being a 24-year-old, 25-year-old young mother with a university education and realizing I've got this university education that so much I know about, and I am completely incompetent at taking care of a little baby. And then I had a very healthy thought, which I'm impressed by all many years later. I thought, I can't be the only mother in this position. There must be other mothers who also are prepared for all kinds of things, but they're not prepared for raising a child. So I decided, okay, I'm going to become a psychologist, and I'm going to help parents with this very huge and overwhelming project of raising a child.
Well, there you
go. It took me many years from that point, because I wanted to wait until my children were a little older.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I was not expecting that answer, but there you go.
and then probably, goodness, it's been a lot of years here. And then probably 15 years later, I made the decision to become a specialist in trauma.
Fantastic. Yeah. Now, something I noticed from just our communications, Janina, was in your email signature, you have a quote from Vaclav Havel. I'm just going to read it out here, and I'd like you to tell me what this quote means to you. So, hope is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out. Could you maybe tell us about this quote and why this quote means something to you?
Well, as you know, many survivors of trauma have lost all hope. They come to us and they say, I have no hope. How can I go on without hope? How can I work on myself if I have no hope? What if I don't believe in myself? And I always say, I used to say, well, you won't have any hope at the beginning. You'll have hope when you see things start to turn around. And then I found the Howell quote, and I realized that was even better than saying you don't have hope at the beginning. You have hope when you get somewhere, which is also true. But I realized that Howell was brilliant. He was absolutely right. Hope is the conviction that something good will come out of our most difficult struggles.
100%.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and very, very important, because when people are struggling, and they're often struggling for years and years and years, it's so important that they believe that there's meaning to that struggle.
Definitely, definitely. It just to have that as a basic orientation and as an approach to life, I just think that's so, so important, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So could you maybe tell us about your experiences working at Bessel van der Kolk's clinic in the 1990s? I'd be curious to hear about what that was like, because that was a very pioneering time in the field.
It was. I was very, very lucky to go to his clinic in 1995 as a supervisor and instructor. But at his clinic, the supervisors sat on the clinical team. So we were a part of all the latest research advances, how they were going to be applied to the clients who came to his center for help. It was very, very, it was exciting. It was also a period where we realized that our old tools weren't going to work, right? Because he is starting in 1994, he wrote his very significant paper called The Body Keeps the Score. In 1994, everybody thought he was crazy as a loon. How could anybody think that the body has anything to do with mental illness? And he stuck to his guns, and on his clinical team, he would keep saying to us about various cases, he would say, "You must go to the body." But nobody knew how. So it was very inspiring, but it also meant, how do we do this thing of going to the body? How do we work with the body when we're trained as talking therapists? So it was exciting. We were kind of discovering how to work with people in different ways, because just talking about what had happened or just talking about the day-to-day struggles were not, you know, the talking cure was not working for trauma.
That makes a lot of sense. And I know you've also worked with Pat Ogden. Could you maybe tell us about your experience working with Pat? And was that before or after your time with Bessel?
That was before, I mean, that was after and during. So in the mid-1990s, Bessel started to do the brain scan research that proved that trauma is remembered more as feelings and body sensations than in a narrative. And he kept saying, go to the body, go to the body. But since none of us knew how to go to the body, he was forced to find people who did know how to work with the body. And he found Pat Ogden. And I was very inspired by the videotapes of her work. So I took her training and became a sensory motor psychotherapist so that I could work. I didn't stop being a psychodynamic therapist, because sensory motor psychotherapy can be woven in with any method that any therapist practices. So it can be woven into EMDR, it can be woven into talking therapies of all kinds, into CBT, into whatever method the practitioner prefers.
100%. So I'd be curious to ask now, what would you say, you've got quite a unique approach to trauma, and you have, I suppose you've integrated many different models in there. You know, you've got things like internal family systems by Richard Schwartz, and there's sensory motor psychotherapy elements in there as well. So what would you say the foundational elements that your approach to trauma work is built upon, Janina?
Well, certainly it's built upon my traditional psychodynamic psychotherapy training, that was my original training way, way back. And then the other important influences included, I did a postdoctoral fellowship with Judith Herman for 2 years. Judith Herman really, really brought an important piece, which is making psychoeducation a therapeutic approach, because the idea in the psychodynamic world, the idea that you educate your clients is just anathema. But Judy Herman said, no, no, no. These are people who've been victimized. They've experienced power over. When you're in a therapeutic relationship, the therapist has power over. Unless the therapist educates the client, so they both know the same things. So that's been a very important influence on my work, and really the reason that I wrote the book Transforming the Living Legacy of Trauma. I learned so much from Bessel, of course, and I learned a lot from his research. That's that I think people underestimate how much we as therapists can be influenced by research. But he did a study that was meant to investigate whether it was true that if people could talk about their traumatic experience, they would be healed from it. Because that's what we believed in the 90s. Just get them to talk about it and they'll be healed. So he did a study comparing two groups of clients who'd experienced the same kind of trauma. One group had been able to put the experience into words. The other group had not. Both groups were equally symptomatic, equally struggling, equally suffering. And so that changed the way we did therapy, because obviously the goal of having someone tell their story was not going to bring anyone the resolution or the relief they were looking for.
100%. That's so interesting. From your point of view, you've sort of had the bird's eye view of how this field has evolved over the years. You know, it's gone from mostly being approached by talking therapies to where it is today. Could you just give us a kind of an overview of your experience of how you've seen it evolve? Because obviously trauma treatment came to the forefront, and we're starting to realize, even as a society, how important this is. So I'd just be curious to get your thoughts on that, you know?
And because trauma is so difficult to treat, the trauma treatment field has always been the sort of the field that was innovating new treatments. And then the rest of the field took hold. So think mindfulness. That idea of working with mindfulness came from the trauma world. Now it's everywhere. EMDR is everywhere now. Internal family systems is everywhere now. and so it's been very exciting. It's been like having a front row seat to the exploration of some distant planet we didn't know about. It's been wonderful.
Fantastic. So I've heard you describe trauma as an adaptation, and a phrase I find really interesting is that, you know, we should be thinking of traumatic experiences almost as a red badge of honor. Is that right? And why do you think about trauma in this way?
Not the experiences, but the symptoms.
Symptoms.
So what I believe is that the symptoms tell the story better than what we remember. Because the symptoms tell us what we took from those experiences, what the effects of those experiences are. And so, you know, so I try to help people understand how their depression helped them survive and adapt, how their anxiety helped them survive and adapt, how their loss of interest or emotion helped them to survive, so that they can appreciate that that's part of the story. Learning to survive by giving up hope is brilliant, right? Right? Because that saves so much energy rather than waking up each day hopeful and then having it squashed like a bug. So there are these adaptations, and it changes people's relationship to their hopelessness when they start to understand it as an ingenious strategy for surviving.
That's, yeah, I've never heard that perspective before. Even like giving up hope can be an adaptation, and one that potentially a very useful one if you're in a situation where it doesn't help you to get up every day and have your hopes completely crushed, you know?
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. So a lot of your work is rooted in, I don't know if it's fair to say or not, but rooted in the structural dissociation model. And I'd just be curious to ask, you know, what can you, if, for someone who hasn't heard of that before, what that is and the purpose of dissociation in your view, Janina, I'd be curious to ask about.
Yes. So let me start by saying something about dissociation. Dissociation is a mental ability. It's something our brains do as a way of organizing information and helping us perform at our best. Everyone's favorite athletes rely on dissociation, right? You know, you hear about, I'm sure, the football player who's just lost his mom or his dad, and everyone just feels brokenhearted for him. And he comes in and he plays his best game ever. That's dissociation, because the mind has that ability to cut off some piece of consciousness, some set of feelings, and focus completely on something else. You know, musicians, every type of performer, peak performer, relies on dissociation to perform at that level. We also dissociate under stress. Doctors, nurses, paramedics all depend on dissociation, right? How else do they manage life or death situations? Their feelings cut out, and they suddenly have access to all this information. Do that, get this medication, right? And it flows because they're dissociated. When we are in a prolonged, unsafe situation, which includes child abuse, domestic violence, war, you know, most types of trauma are prolonged. It's not one bad thing that happens and then there's a happy childhood. It's a prolonged experience of being trapped in a dangerous situation. And so the brain relies more on dissociation, especially, we believe, when the abuse starts very young. So when children have no ability to protect themselves. Mm. And the structural dissociation model says that there is a survival-oriented way that our brains are organized to dissociate when necessary. Because the brain isn't actually one thing. The brain is made up of many structures that communicate with each other through neural networks. And we're split, you know, we have a left brain and we have a right brain. So that's the biggest structural split in the brain. And it lends itself to helping us survive difficult situations. And that's the structural dissociation model is called structural because it's based on the premise that the structure of the brain creates the sort of playing field to be able to fragment and dissociate to survive. And so the theory says that under traumatic stress, the physical split between the left and right brains becomes more dissociated, right? So there's a physiological split, but there's also dissociation interfering with communication back and forth. So that part of us, the left brain part of us, keeps on keeping on, you know, dusts him or herself off and carries on. And the right brain side of the personality remains vigilant and poised for the next and the next and the next assault. So the old theories of dissociation were focused on this idea that dissociation created little kind of capsules of memory, that dissociation was a way to avoid remembering. This theory, the structural dissociation theory, says, no. Dissociation is a way of ensuring that we make it to the next day. So it's really different change in perspective. So I immediately felt that this theory was solid ground for any therapist because it wasn't based on a metaphor or an idea. It was actually based on neurology. So I started using it in probably the mid to late 90s. And then I was also really influenced by internal family systems because that too is about fragmented parts of the personality. And it has wonderful techniques, but not a solid scientific foundation. So I put the two together, the solid foundation of structural dissociation theory with the beautiful techniques of IFS and contributions from sensory motor and clinical hypnosis and CBT and many other things. And I created my approach, which is called trauma-informed stabilization treatment, or TIST, T-I-S-T, because all trauma treatments have to have initials, right?
Right. So, it's makes very it, true.
It's right. It is true. And so it's very exciting to be able to help people who have been the most difficult to treat, who haven't understood themselves, whom therapists haven't understood, that suddenly makes sense if we look through the lens of this bottle.
That's so interesting. So you had this very, you know, this very unique and original insight that if you put these two things together, it was going to create something completely new. So I'd just be curious, was that something that was probably, you know, mulling around for you for a long time? And then did it just sort of come to you one day, like in a flash, or was it a gradual thing? And what was the response like whenever you first put your theory and new approach out into the field? Was it welcomed? Did you get pushback for it?
Well, you know, as many, many therapists will attest, you know, we learn through trial and error we wing it. You know, we when we don't know what to do, we make something up. And if it works, we do it again. So the trauma field especially has always been a field where therapists have had to bring a little of this and a little of that, right? CBT alone doesn't work. CBT with presented in a more trauma-informed way is much more user-friendly. You know, prolonged exposure doesn't work for most trauma survivors. It may look good in the research, but 40 to 50% of clients flee treatment because it's too overwhelming for them. And so, you know, again, we take a little of this and a little of that, and we've always done that in the trauma field. So it didn't seem strange to me to take these pieces and put them together, test them out with my clients, because I was working for years with these ideas with my clients, and I could see which did they respond well to, what was universally not liked or wasn't helpful. And I just kept refining it. And then actually the best thing that happened, I was very blessed to be invited by two different hospitals for the chronically mentally ill in the US. I was invited to help them develop a trauma-informed way of treating these psychiatric, chronically mentally ill clients, many of whom had been in hospital for 2 to 10 years. Right? When I say chronically mentally ill, I mean people who were not safe to leave the institutional walls for prolonged periods. And so we took the lowest functioning clients, the most struggling clients, and I tried out this method with them. And to the delight and surprise of all of us, they responded. So when we reinterpreted their chronic suicidality as a suicidal part, whose intention was to protect them rather than kill them, it totally changed their relationship to their suicidal ideation and impulses. Right? So when we reinterpreted their depression as a depressed child part, it changed their relationship to the depression. Right? When we reinterpreted hopelessness as the hopelessness of a child trapped in a world where there was no hope, that changed their relationship to the hopelessness. And so we saw, and we had a number of clients who had been self-injuring for years. So we treated the self-injury as a part, trying to relieve distressing feelings. And when the clients began to relate to the self-injury as the modus operandi of a part, they started saying, well, I don't know if I want to do what that part wants me to do, because it gets me into trouble. Right? Every time I self-injure, I'm stuck in this hospital for another series of weeks or months. And it's getting a bit tedious. Luckily the acceptance of it came first from the clients. And so then I wasn't as worried about acceptance from the field as a whole, because the most important people had accepted it, which were the people for whom it was meant. And I was very thrilled when my book, Healing the Fragmented Cells, was published and had such a wonderful response, because it was a little scary to write it. It was meant that I was putting these ideas out for the world to hate or love. Right. So it felt a little exposing and a little bit of a risk. But the response has, especially from trauma survivors, has been wonderful. People write me almost every week saying, thank you so much for writing this book. I've never understood myself. I've had terrible troubles in therapy. No therapist wants to work with me. It's always a disaster. I read your book and now I understand why. And many who say, so I bought your book and I brought it in for my therapist and I asked her to read it. So it's been lovely. It's been very validating for me, but most of all validating for the trauma survivors.
Well, I just want to commend you for doing that, because that must have taken a lot of courage at the time. It must not have been easy to do, but you definitely did the right thing.
Yes. Yes.
So we've covered it, or you've described it there a few times, but I know I'd like to sort of start talking about the parts paradigm in trauma work. And maybe if we could start off by just talking about the problem with the uniconsciousness model, especially when working with trauma, and why the parts paradigm is a more effective way of working.
Well, you know, as any trauma survivor will tell us, a traumatized brain and nervous system intensifies any feeling or experience we have. So what is so difficult for most trauma survivors is they constantly feel overwhelmed by the intensity of their emotions, or they're numb and they feel sort of equally overwhelmed by the inability to feel. You know, the impulses, it's because they're survival related, are so intense. If you think of, for instance, suicidal actions as fight responses, you know, the amount of energy in a fight response is incredibly intense. So people feel constantly crazy, afraid of their own feelings, either overwhelmed or completely cut off. And having a way to relate to those feelings, right? So if I'm just going to use, I'll use my phone as right? So if, and so funny, because what's coming up on my phone is a text message from a client saying, I'm really triggered and overwhelmed. Do you have time to see me today? So that's kind of perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. So if she, and she says in her message, she says, I can't stop crying. So I'm going to be her. If I feel that overwhelming sadness and I can't stop crying, and I notice it as a part, if I say, okay, it's not that I can't stop crying, this part of me can't stop crying. That changes the relationship to the feelings. They're still there, but they're not as intense, right? Because if we see someone crying, we say, oh, this is so sad. They're so sad. But we may feel for them, but we don't feel the same intensity. So as soon as you call it apart, you change the relationship to the feeling. Right. And you can be more curious about it rather than to feel it's going to drown you.
100%. Something I've heard you say elsewhere, Janina, is that, you know, many trauma survivors find it difficult to have compassion for themselves. But whenever you're able to separate parts, and it's a lot easier to have compassion for maybe an 8-year-old version of yourself that's been through the trauma than it is your current self. Could you maybe tell us a bit more about that and why that might help people?
Well, because my theory is no one knows, just to start off, right? Let's admit what we don't know. No one knows why trauma survivors have almost a phobia of self-compassion. They have very strong reactions. You're asking me to have compassion for myself? How could you? My theory is that that's because self-compassion is dangerous in a dangerous world. Right? We can't afford to pause and have compassion for ourselves, because we have to be on high alert. We have to be on guard, have to be ready to run, have to be ready to hide. And so self-compassion doesn't work. You know, can you imagine a soldier at war pausing to have a few moments of self-compassion? It's not safe. But most every trauma survivor I've ever met, I actually can't think of anyone of the hundreds or thousands of trauma survivors I've met in 41 years of practice, I've never met anyone who didn't have compassion for small animals, for children, for people who are hurt or wounded or infirm in some way. And so I saw in my clients, they have a wealth of compassion for everyone else. They just can't have it for themselves. So I started saying, well, you don't have to have compassion for yourself, but you do need to have compassion for that little boy who went through so much. It's not fair. And when they say, well, I just wish he'd go away, I don't have any compassion, I say, so really, are you the kind of person who, if you see a child on the street looking upset, you just walk by and say, shut up, you little brat? Is that what you do? And they are all like, no, no. And I say, well, what would you do if you saw the little boy on the street? And they all say universally, say, well, I'd get down to his level and I'd say, little boy, are you all right? Right? Is somebody here to take care of you? And right, so they behave compassionately. And I said, okay, that's all I'm asking you to do with this other little boy who happens to be inside you. And so they learn. They learn how to use that same compassion they have for their dog, their cat, the little child in the, you know, in the supermarket who is crying in the middle of the aisle. They learn to take that compassion and offer it to their young wounded parts.
100%. I don't know if you've ever had a dialogue with Professor Paul Gilbert. He developed compassion-focused therapy. Yeah.
Yes, I'm a big fan of Paul Gilbert's.
Yeah, he's been part of the summit as well. He's an absolute legend. So something I find really interesting about your work, Janina, is this idea that our internal relationship with ourselves, something I read in one of your books, is that this is more important for feeling safe in day-to-day life than our external relationships with others. This how this how we relate to ourselves internally. That's so, so important. And could you maybe talk about, is it earn secure attachment? Is that the right? Can you tell us about that there and how people can start actually developing that and cultivating that kind of relationship internally? You know, because I think if you can gift somebody that there, there are very few things that could be of more benefit to anybody in their life, you know, to have that kind of relationship with themselves.
Right. And it's easier to get there by having those relationships with one's parts, because it's much more complicated. You know, self-acceptance is more complicated because I've got to accept the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? And that's a big package to accept. But I can help people accept their parts and develop some affection and empathy for those parts. And when they start to have warm feelings toward their parts, that really, when this is the great thing about the body perspective, we humans have a brain that allows us to imagine experiences we've never had. And when we imagine those experiences, we evoke the same emotional and physical reactions we would if we were actually having those experiences. So when I help my clients to put an arm around a child part of themselves, to offer acceptance and warmth toward this little child, they start to feel the feelings of secure attachment that none of them have had for a minute. But it's like teaching my grown-up brain to offer that secure attachment to the child parts of me. And when we do that, we start to develop an internal sense of secure attachment, which is what earned secure attachment is. It's the development of secure attachment as an adult.
Very interesting, very interesting. So it's similar to the self-leadership and IFS, I suppose. Self with a capital uh-huh. S.
Yeah. You know, I think this is a very interesting difference between me and Dick Schwartz. I love Dick. He's a wonderful man. I've known him for decades. I've been a fan of his work since 1996. So, we've been around the block together more times than he even knows. but I like ways of working that are grounded a little more in science, because then I feel I can have confidence in what I'm doing. And I can see more clearly if something's not working, why it might not be working, because I understand the brain and the body responses. So to me, there's a difference between self energy, which is really mindful consciousness, and the way in which mindful consciousness toward parts creates the same kind of secure attachment relationship. Mm. Right? It's like, because mindfulness is inherently compassionate, it doesn't judge, it's interested, even if it's a little, you know, that's the beauty of mindful consciousness, is we learn in mindfulness to be as content with what we're horrified by as by what we like and approve of. So I have IFS does a beautiful job of that.
Yeah, definitely. And I like what you've said there about, you know, you love understanding the science behind things, because then you can always sort of, you can try something out and then check it against the theory and figure out what's working and what's not, and then maybe apply a new theory, you know. Mm-hmm. A question that just popped into my mind there, I'm just going to ask it because I'm really curious. You've worked with so many people and helped to, you know, reduce a lot of suffering in people's lives. What's your view on what's possible for human consciousness? You know, how good could it get if we were to really, you know, get this right? And yeah, I'm just, if nothing comes to mind there, don't worry about it. It's just something I'm curious to ask you.
No, I think it's one of those, you know, those kind of existential questions that's very important. We may not be able to answer it, but we at least can ask it. Right. And you know, that is something we don't understand. We don't understand why some people are more resilient than others. We don't understand why some people recover spontaneously from traumatic events and other people suffer for years and decades. And if we knew the answer, you know, if we knew the answer, we could help everyone be more resilient, right? Right? The thought is that secure attachment in childhood conveys a resilience, gives us, it's like, you know, getting vaccinated. we get immunized with all this positive, safe, secure attachment, and it has a buffering effect against stress. Mm. And so that's both a very sad and a very hopeful explanation. Very sad because it takes so much for parents to offer secure attachment. I don't know if you're a parent, but trust me, it's a lot of work. And not, you know, and many parents are living at the edge of their, right? They're just struggling to get through each day and feed their children. They much less to have the ability to offer them safety and security. So we shall see. There are more mysteries to solve.
I never would have thought of that, but it does make a lot of sense that the foundational element here is a secure attachment relationship. And it makes me think, you know, in the future, you have ways of understanding different people's attachment styles. So, you know, in schools for young people, if they figure out, or if they're testing attachment styles early on, maybe you figure out the child or the children with insecure attachments, and then you figure out ways to help them out earlier on to develop that internal relationship. I don't know. It's certainly possible and could do a lot of good. Absolutely. You know?
And also, if we treat children as not good or bad, right? Here are the good children. Here are the bad children. If we assume that bad behavior represents an attachment problem, we're going to treat children differently. I've worked in schools, and I know how teachers, you know, how teachers can have gut reactions to children who are difficult to teach that are quite negative, because they don't understand what it is that's impeding the child's ability to even sit in a classroom.
100%. So we've only got a few minutes left, Janina, and it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you today and learn just a little bit from you. Three books that you would recommend that every mental health professional should read.
Wow, that is a tall order. Definitely The Body Keeps the Score, Bessel van der Kolk's book. At the cost of, you know, patting myself on the back too much, I would recommend my book, Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors. And then, you know, the third one, that's a tough choice. And I'm torn between, this is a very old book, but it's a wonderful book. It's a book by Nancy Napier, N-A-P-I-E-R, called, it's called Getting Through the Day. I just for a moment blanked. It's called Getting Through the Day, Strategies for People Hurt as Children.
Okay.
And it's a lovely book. It taught me there so much as a therapist. It's a book that I've recommended to clients for years and years and years.
Fantastic.
And then I would, that's tied in a way. My fourth choice, I'm going to throw in a fourth choice, would be Dick Schwartz's Introduction to the Internal Family Systems Method.
Okay. Okay. That's cool. So just a final question, Janina, pronounced that wrong. If you could give advice to someone, there's two ways you could approach this question, okay? So if you could give advice to your younger self before you began training as a clinical psychologist, what would you tell that young woman? Or another way to approach it is to, you know, for someone listening to this, that's a mental health professional who wants to be the best they can be at helping others. What would you tell that person as well? So approach it whatever way you like.
Well, you know, it immediately takes me back to what I call being a junior therapist as a child. You know, so many of us come into this profession having already been, you know, been precocious little therapists in our families of origin. And so I would love to have told my younger self, you know, this isn't great, but you can use what you're learning in helping your family to help other people and be appreciated for it. Because what my little self didn't know is that someday I would be appreciated for trying to help people.
Janina, that's really everything. I want to say thank you so much for your time today. I've loved speaking with you.
Thank you.
Before you go, where can people find more information about your work online, your website, your upcoming trainings, how to train with in the TIST model? Can you tell us a bit there?
Yes. On my website, which is JaninaFisher.com, there should be information about all of those things and more. And also, I'm happy to receive people's emails and direct them toward what they're seeking. And my email address is drjjfisher@aol.com. I hope you have a wonderful summit. I'm sure that you will. And it's been a pleasure to be a part of it.
Thank you so much, Nina. This has definitely been one of the highlights so far. So I really appreciate it.